This is my son, the beloved. Listen to him. As they were coming down the mountain, he ordered no one to say anything about it until after the Son of Man had been risen from the dead. Now this one's easier to say, this is the good news, and kind of proclaim it. Some of the other Gospels, we make light of that phrasing at the end, but this is indeed good news. Good morning. Welcome to St. Nick's. I am glad you're here. It is a special Sunday. It's the last Sunday after the season, or after the Epiphany, or the conclusion of the season of kind of an ordinary time where we wear green. And it's my first Sunday back. That makes it special, right? Someone said, you didn't tell us you were leaving so that we, you know, we'd still come. And I said, I was afraid that if you knew I was gone, that there would be more people. But apparently not. I did have a fantastic opportunity this last week. I went to Houston for a conference with Brené Brown. Some of you may know her as an author of several New York Times bestsellers, and have been given a TED Talk. If you haven't, you should probably look up the TED Talk. She's quite good. She's got a lot of work around shame and shame resilience, and an understanding of how we develop our own way in this world. And more on that later, perhaps. But the tremendous opportunity. Roughly 250 clergy gathered at Camp Allen outside of Houston. And it was interesting for me. I don't think I've ever been to a gathering quite like that. I mean, I've been to like general convention where it's just run them up with too many clergy everywhere you turn. But never for something like this. And it was a fantastic time and a great learning. And also, I saw seminary classmates that I hadn't seen since seminary, which is always kind of a nice treat to run into people that you know. And I met some new friends along the way. I also got, for the first time, to see my brother-in-law preaching. Some of you already know this. I've got two brother-in-laws that are Episcopal priests, too, which was the source of some discussion at the conference, as you might imagine. And it's particularly amusing because they're very different in their style and what have you. Neil has been married to my sister Carrie for 10 years, more than 10 years, and I've never been in worship with him, not like this, not at his house of worship. So I got to see him process in and help lead worship and preach, and then I got to sit with him in a worship service at the conference too. Both were like first time for both of us. So we were kind of chuckling about that, having known each other for so long and yet never having had that opportunity. I got to throw my nephews around too, which is always fun. They always think Uncle Paul is a jungle gym. Can't imagine where they got that at. In all seriousness, as much fun as it was to go and do all of those things, I was delighted to come home. In all fairness to my beloved wife, I've been gone the last two Valentine's Day, and I wasn't going to make it three. I flew in yesterday, and the kids were in dance, so she got to pick me up, and we had like half an hour by ourselves. It's an unbelievable thing. Welcomed home well by my beloved Sarah and my kids, and had a nice family dinner and a chance to catch up a little bit with them. And I'm also delighted to be here because the reading today is so spectacular. So each year, as we conclude the season that follows the Epiphany, the revelation of God to us is, you know, it's kind of what we're celebrating. The church has the audacity to say that Epiphany is ordinary time, meaning it's kind of like the space between some other bigger seasons. But, I mean, how much better can you get than a season named after, like, God revealing God's self to us? I don't think there's not much. I mean, Easter, yeah, okay, that's bad. You get the picture, but this is like a great season unto itself. And it concludes each year with a reading of the Transfiguration, which isn't just some cool word that we get like out of Harry Potter. It turns out it's all about God revealing himself in full like majesty to a few disciples. Not even all 12 were there with him. Only 3 are named as going up. And we get this sense where Jesus does this a lot. I mean, if you read through any of the Gospels, as Jesus goes through his ministry, he retreats often to prayer. You know, he'll be going along preaching and teaching and healing, and then he'll disappear and he'll be off praying. He'll be like, where did he go? Sometimes he's trying to escape a crowd. Sometimes he just needs to reconnect. And what an example to us that is. But this time he takes three disciples with him. And this gospel passage even begins 6 days later. And it's like, I had to go and look just to be sure, but it's like 6 days after what? 6 days later, you know, what was the context? So the context here is that 6 days after Jesus and his disciples have a conversation about who do people say that I am? Now this passage may, some of you are nodding, I know that passage. And then he continues, and some said John the Baptist, and some said Elijah. And he says, but who do you say that I am? And it's Peter who stands and says, you're the Christ, the Messiah, the one. You're the man. You're it. You're the thing. You know. And so 6 days after that, Peter, James, and John go up this mountain, apart, away. Go up the mountain with Jesus, a time away from the crowds, away from having the demands of many, away from the city, away from what's known, up to a mountain together. And while they're there, away from everybody else, make sure we get this, we're away from everybody else, and Jesus is transfigured before them. It says, his clothes were made dazzling white, such that no one on earth could have bleached them this way. They didn't know our altar guilt. But, you know, times were different. Times were different. No OxyClean. Clorox, maybe, I don't know. But truly majestic moment where any doubts, any questions, any reservations that these three guys had were assuaged, wiped out, eliminated, gone for good. He's transfigured in a way that his divinity, his connection to God, his being God, is made clear. And there next to him, he's having a conversation with Elijah and Moses. Who are these guys? I mean, we read about them in Scripture. We had one reading about Elijah today. But Elijah really, especially for people in that time, Elijah is kind of the quintessential prophet. He's like the summation of prophets. He's the absolute prophet. If you're going to have one prophet, it's Elijah. Not that there were others, but like he's the guy. He's the guy who represents prophecy to us. So, and then on the other side is Moses. And Moses is attributed to have written the first five books of our Bible, the Torah, the law. So there with Jesus is all of the prophets and all of the law having a conversation about what's happening as Jesus is transfigured, majestic, and completely dazzling, audaciously white. And it's overwhelming and terrifying all at the same time. And Peter doesn't quite know what to make of it. So he's like, I've got an idea. You know, I'll build three booths, three monuments, three hallmark things to mark this occasion. Because Peter's grasping and trying to hang on to it with whatever he can. Because he wants to be able to come back to this place and remember what happened here. He wants to be able to relive the moment. He wants to be able to bring other people and honor the significance of this major event that happens as they follow Jesus. And Jesus kind of ignores the request. It's like, and things proceed, and then the voice of God is heard. This is my son, the beloved. Listen to me. All these commentators you read about the different aspects of the Gospels. Mark is a short Gospel, 16 chapters. It's not very long. I told you he's kind of the immediately guy. He goes immediately from one thing to the next. They say, you know, clearly the baptism in the beginning of Jesus' ministry is a major event, and the death, and then the resurrection. You know, there's like three major events. This is number four, perhaps, on a list of five of major events that happen that show Christ's followers, beyond any questions, the authority that he has, the divinity that he has, the majesty, and that beyond any doubt, they know that he is the Messiah, the Savior, the one who's come to lead them to all truth, to all wisdom, to all love. It's no wonder Peter wanted to create some kind of monument, some kind of booth. My hope is that some of you have had these kinds of experiences. In fact, I know that some of you have had these. My real hope, honestly, is that all of you have or will have some kind of majestic transfiguration kind of experience in your life where Jesus is made abundantly known and clear to you. I hope that even as that inner being calls for you to just preserve that moment and build some kind of booth or monument, that you might go back to that place and revisit it and maybe bring a friend. And this is the kind of thing where I think I connect to the story. I understand where Peter's coming from because I've come away from retreats like last week and other events in my life where Jesus has been made very clear to me, and I want to hang on to it, and I want to be able to bring my friends to it. I want to be able to share it. And I think part of the reason Jesus doesn't let the booths get built is because he recognizes that most of life isn't lived at the mountaintop apart from the city, away from everything else and the demands of everything else. But it's lived in between the mountaintop experiences, and we need to learn to find ways to pursue God's love, trust, and wisdom, and we need to find ways to connect with it even in between the mountaintops. That we're not going to be able to live life in those mountaintop moments alone, that they might be enough to nourish us and connect us to God in transformative and transfigurative kind of ways, that knowledge and understanding and experience might carry us through the depths of the valleys below and everything else. Because it's those moments at the mountaintops, they might make clear to us some sense of who God is and the call and direction for us in our lives. But it's in the living between the mountaintops that we become God's disciples. My hope and my prayer for us is that as we pass from this season of Epiphany into a season of Lent, of self-reflection and meditation, that we might find ways to connect ourselves to be God's disciples, both on the mountaintops and in between. And that we might not do it alone, but that we might do it as a community of faith, pursuing God each and every day.
Please stand. We'll affirm our faith with the words of the Nicene Creed.